Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamarais.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Marais, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Hi everyone, welcome back to another Books with Hooks. Today's a special one because we do have our author joining us, Jennifer Wright Berryman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it so very much.
Yeah, we love having authors on the show. We get to brainstorm and bounce ideas off of you, and it becomes a much more interactive format. Right, so Jennifer, will you please read us your query letter?
Yes. Dear Cece, endless thanks to you, Bianca, and Carly for the wealth of invaluable information and experience you share on the Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm submitting my manuscript to you based on your love of edgy psychological suspense by women and for women. Dexter meets Shawshank Redemption, but with women in Hope Can Kill, a 72,000-word fast-paced thriller about a therapist-turned-serial killer, perfect for fans of My Lovely Wife by Samantha Downing, The Hunting Wives by Mae Cobb, and They Never Learn by Lane Fargo. Hope Can Kill is a standalone novel with series potential. Trigger content warning: violence against women, including interpersonal violence and brutality of a male prison guard. Hope Shepherd, a therapist for women who are victims of interpersonal violence, is in a Michigan prison for killing the five men who'd threatened the lives of their partners, her support group patients. Her vengeance gives her a savior complex and fuels a craving to continue ridding the world of abusive men. Some inmates and prison staff laud her as a savior, but a male guard makes Hope a target, and she learns what it means to be a victim. Meanwhile, Hope's husband becomes distant, and her support group members, the five wives, continue to heal without her expert guidance. Hope's status as a hero is dissolving until a female guard solicits her help to take care of the guard's violent brother-in-law. With the undercover aid of the guard and a network of women aligned with her mission, Hope successfully elopes to kill the guard's abusive brother-in-law, but she's too late. He's been murdered by someone else. When she sees on the news that another man has been murdered similarly just days later, Hope realizes she has a copycat who aims to steal her murderous crown. Threats from the male guard escalate, and Hope wants to eliminate him and take back her power, but time is running short, and she has to call upon everyone in her circle of trust if she's going to get to him first. I am a social work professor with over 25 years of experience working in an emergency mental health, prisons and jails, and with victims of violence. Although I wouldn't hurt a fly, I didn't have to stretch my brain to conceptualize this book. I've spent the last 15 years writing academically, boring, and writing fiction as part of my academic writing recovery plan. I live in the Midwest where the corn grows high and the summer humidity makes my sweat sweaty. Thank you for your time and consideration of Hope Can Kill. I have submitted the first 5 pages below per your submission requirements. May I send you the full manuscript? Warmly, Jennifer.
Wonderful, Jennifer. Thank you so much for that. Okay, I think, Carly, we're going to start with you in terms of your feedback there.
All right. Thank you so much for reading it, Jennifer. And like Bianca says, I love having authors on the show. This is always so fun for us. Okay. All right. So starting at the top, at first I was like, okay, the Dexter and the Shawshank, I was like, okay, maybe we're doing too much with the TV film comps. But then right after the title, you get into the book comp. So it ends up being a lot of comps. Do I think that's a bad thing? not necessarily, but it is just a whole lot of comps, but it does the job of kind of explain, you know, therapist turned serial killer, here's the category, this is the vibe we're going for. At the end of the day, does the Dexter and Shawshank help? I mean, because in this context, publishing people are going to know the books and potentially know the shows, but the context of the books is kind of more important. So anyway, just flagging that for you. In terms of the trigger / content warning, I think ultimately this can probably go in the top of the synopsis. I don't think it necessarily needs to go here. Like, obviously there's some kind of like quote on the page, unquote, you know, things happening, but I don't know, for the purpose of the query letter, I don't know if we necessarily need it. So I would just say, you know, potentially you might want to move that to the synopsis itself. Okay, so now my question's about the content itself. At first, I mean, we kind of know that she does it, right? Because it's like she's a therapist turned serial killer. So you spell it, she did it. But then you're like, you know, in Michigan prison for killing the five men. I don't know. I guess I maybe just wanted a little bit of like feeling unsettled a little bit at the beginning. It's very much like she did it. She's in prison. And I'm like, okay, where's the unsettled feeling? I guess the unsettled feeling lies with the fact that she's a serial killer. That is unsettling. But it felt very factual. And then the whole like what happens in backstory versus what is happening in the story piece is kind of interesting, because it's actually a huge deal that like this character killed five men. She's a serial killer. That's a whole lot of plot. But you're saying like, oh, that's backstory. That's not actually this story. And I'm like, okay, what is in this story to make that backstory? That's the piece that's kind of interesting to me. And you give us a huge reason to care, which is, you know, obviously the violence that's happened to these five women. You know, there's that passion there. And we're like, okay, yeah, she's getting her justice for all of womankind. So that is a bit interesting to me. The husband, how much does he know? Obviously, we're going to get to this a bit more in the pages, but here you just say Hope's husband becomes distant while she's in prison. I'm like, yeah, I mean, that's not surprising. Like, does he want to divorce her? Like, what's the stakes here? Are they short on cash? Like, there has to be those like interpersonal stakes for her while she's in prison. That was just kind of assumed to me, like a husband would become distant if the wife is in prison. That's logical. And that the support group members are going to need to find a new therapist because she's a convicted criminal. So all of that was a bit like logical to me. So I think what you're trying to do here is kind of explain the bigger why of why does it all matter now? And then obviously there is violence against her and she is a victim. That's obviously super serious and very intense. I guess what I'm also really curious about is, because you talk about like wanting to take back the power, but she is an inmate in prison. Essentially through this whole book is kind of what my understanding is. It says she successfully elopes to kill the guard's abusive brother-in-law, but isn't she already married? Who is she eloping with? Like, I have a whole lot of questions, I guess, which is a good thing that you're here so we can kind of talk through the actual plot of the book, I think, to figure out the what is exactly happening in prison. And essentially the whole book is happening in prison. I think those are my big question marks.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, we'll hand it across to you before we come back to Jennifer to get some questions answered for us.
Thank you. Okay, so I will also start at the top. If there has ever been a pitch for me, a therapist turned serial killer is probably it. So I was very excited to read this and I was like, this is an amazing premise. I want more. What Carly said about the comps hadn't occurred to me, to be totally honest, because I was just very excited about the premise. But now that she mentioned it, I actually think you should cut Dexter meets Shawshank. My lovely wife is doing a lot of the heavy lifting and the other two books are working as well. So just for the sake of keeping it tight, because remember, agents read query letters in batches, cut. So then moving to the first plot paragraph, when I read a sentence like, her vengeance gives her a savior complex and fuels a craving to continue ridding the world of abusive men, the first thing that occurs to me is, look, I love psychoanalyzing a character as much as the next person, but psychoanalyzing does not belong in the query letter. You're going deep into her motivation. You're talking about her savior complex. You're talking about a craving. These are things that exist within our layers of our consciousness and unconscious. And so that's really important. And I love that you know that does not belong in the query letter. So I'd cut. And then moving on to the second paragraph, which starts with meanwhile, you know, I was reading the first sentence and I was like, okay, does this mean this is multi-POV? Because why are we focusing on the support group, the five whys, continuing to heal without her expert guidance? Like, I don't think it's multi-POV. And if it's not, like, that's not how we're supposed to be framing the story. If you want to frame the story in terms of making what's happening with the support group really relevant, then you have to frame it through Hope's point of view. It can't just be they continue to heal. Same with her husband, really, because I thought that her husband would then come up later when we discuss the rest of the plot. And having read the entire query letter, I'm wondering, why is her husband growing distant relevant? To Carly's point, it is logical. It's something we're going to assume. And if it were a subversion of expectations, then it might make sense. But it's not. It's something that's, again, logical. And so we don't see him being relevant at all in the story, based on the query letter, of course. Or her support group, to be totally honest, although she does call on the people around her, so maybe they're included in that. When I read that she has to take care of the guard's violent brother-in-law, my first question was, is it in exchange for protection against the male guard who's targeting her? I'm asking this to understand how the plot points are connected, because I'm getting a lot of plot points, the husband being distant, the support group moving on, the male guard going after her, this other guard asking her for help, and I'm not seeing causality. I'm not seeing dominoes tipping over. And I really wanted to see that. I always tell people, beware of the satellite plot points. That's when your plot points are orbiting the sun, which is the book. What you want them is to like have the dominoes tipping over effect. The word elope. So I highlighted that and I was like, you've got to get rid of this word. Yes, technically elope means escape, but everyone thinks of elope as marriage. Like, get rid of this word, write escape, unless you actually mean she's trying to get married to someone. And if that's the case, then I'm just lost. The last sentence of that paragraph, Hope realizes she has a copycat who aims to steal her murderous crown. I was like, okay, so the climax is going to be connected to the copycat, right? Because somehow the copycat's going to get her in trouble. But we don't get information on how the copycat gets her in trouble. So again, I'm thinking satellite plot point as opposed to dominoes tipping over, which made me curious. And I'm very glad that this is one where we have you on, because I get to ask. I get to ask, like, how is the husband, you know, growing distant connected? How is the copycat connected? Not just as something she discovers, but as something that causes actual change to the plot. And I also want to say that the line, although I wouldn't hurt a fly, I didn't have to stretch my brain to conceptualize this book, is the best line I've ever read in an author paragraph. So very much congratulations.
Jennifer, we're now handing across to you. So can you answer some of these questions for us so that we can perhaps see where these causality issues can be tied up and perhaps polished up in the query?
Yeah, this feedback is just excellent. It's priceless. I really appreciate it. And I took copious notes here. I'd like to first laugh at myself in terms of the word elope, because this is where it is so critical to get other sets of eyes on the language that we use, the words that we use. And so in my mind, elope from prison, escape from prison, you know, that's really, really helpful to think about, you know, using a much better word there. So that's the easiest sort of low hanging fruit here. But in terms of questions and how these plot points are not fitting together, this is really making sense for me. And, you know, I think this particular version of the query certainly suffers from, oh gosh, you know, boiling a book down into, you know, sort of several plot points. And to your question, Cece, about the husband and, you know, kind of how he looks like he's sort of dropped into the query and how is he connected and, you know, and his distance. And then how does this sort of copycat translate into the final climax? This is where my query letter is suffering from, oh my gosh, I don't want to give too much away. There's so many sort of things happening behind curtains in this book that my protagonist is unaware of. And she finds out as the story goes along that is affecting her outcomes. And so that's where I think this query letter gets a little muddled, is because I'm trying to keep those behind the curtain, and that's making it sort of confusing. So, you know, that's really helpful feedback. And you're absolutely right. I feel that your feedback about, you know, oh gosh, is this multi POV or is this single? Because it's single POV. It is Hope's single POV. And the fact that, you know, my query letter does unfortunately lend itself to, oh my goodness, that question of, you know, is this single POV, is this multiple, you know, dual multiple POV, means that I definitely need to make sure that that is written from her perspective and that it flows in a way that's connecting a lot better. So this has been really helpful. I took a lot of notes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jennifer. For Carly and Cece, you know, it's kind of tough because if you were writing the actual book in third person close or third person, you could, in the query letter, write things like unbeknownst to Hope, X, Y, and Z, right? But considering this is first-person narrative, how does she get around those kind of plot points that the character doesn't know, but that she doesn't want to hide too much?
My advice is going to sound like lazy advice, but I promise it's advice I would give to my sister. I would go to the books that are told in first person and see how they did it in their pitch copy, like in the same space, right? Like the thriller, suspense-y books. I loved My Lovely Wife, but I read it, I read it as soon as it came out. So what, 4 years ago, 5 years ago? I don't remember. I'm pretty sure it's first person point of view. And I remember the pitch copy started with like couple language, like our love story is whatever. I forget what the adjective was, but then it turned into I. Like there was an I point of view, a first person point of view, even in the pitch copy. And that was fun. And I didn't have to do that, but I would just look at those books because I understand the challenge, but you are allowed in the query letter to tell me things that she doesn't know, even though in the pages you're not. Like that is fine. That is allowed in the query letter. So that's one of the ways to do it. But if you're like super precious about it and you're like, well, I really wanted to, you know, kind of stay true to how much she knows, what you can do is when you come to the revelation, not tell us what the revelation is, but she will soon learn that, I'm just going to say a random example here, you know, that the reason she got caught and went to jail isn't the one she thought it was. And someone close to her betrayed her. I don't know what your story is, but that far ahead. But it could be something like that. And again, I don't know if I'm being helpful at all, and I'm sorry. But like those are maybe good starting points for you.
Yeah, I was nodding along with the, like, is she angry to be in jail or how did she get caught? That's something she knows that's super interesting and important and not really giving a lot away because we know she's in jail. One thing I was making notes of as Cece was talking was, like, potentially when you're writing in first person, you have the opportunity, and I'm saying this in this way because not everybody should be doing this, but you have an opportunity to write a voicier query. And I was making myself some notes like, you know, Hope has three goals. Number one, kill the five men who da-da-da-da-da. Number two, stay out of jail. Number three, like, keep her murderous, you know, villain crown, da-da-da-da-da. And then you do the whole, like, and two of these three things never worked out. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like, you write, like, a voicier query like that where we really understand that we are in her point of view and we're seeped in it and we understand the stakes for her individually. But I agree. I think we need to know if she is upset about being caught or not and if she's angry. And I think that, like, anger really isn't on the page yet. Maybe it isn't anger. Maybe, I don't know, wouldn't you be angry if you're in prison? Like, even though you did it? I don't know. Like, you had to get caught. Either you made a mistake, so you're mad at yourself for making a mistake about getting caught. Number two, somebody turned you in. Number three, you blame it on the cops. No, I'm trying to say none of that is on the page. And I think that could all be very important.
That's incredibly helpful. And actually, your feedback is so validating because as I've done iterations of this query letter, some of the things that you have been mentioning are things that I have been thinking about, you know, playing around with. And I always wonder about, because I know I've heard you all talk about interiority, and I never know how much of that to put in a query letter and how that balances with voiciness. So, you know, that's also something that I think can be really sort of tricky in a query letter versus the synopsis where you have a touch more space to really dig in.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult. And I giggled when you mentioned an earlier iteration of the query letter because it is. It's really, really tough. And hats off to you. Hats off to you, Jennifer. Okay, so let's now move on to your pages. Will you give us a brief outline of what's in them? And then we will begin with Cece's critique.
Sure. We open with Hope and her husband, Simon, setting up for the alibi for Hope's first abusive husband kill. They're eating dinner at a restaurant, and Hope makes a scene with the waiter, changing her food order and sending the wine back, trying to make sure she gets noticed by the waiter in case she needs an alibi. Then they go to a bar filled with people watching a hockey game. Hope and Simon, her husband, join the crowd and they engage with the fans in this sort of raucous cheers and jeers, again, making sure that they're seen and that their presence is there and memorable. After the hockey game, while the fans are bemoaning the loss, Hope sneaks off to the bathroom, changes into her dark kill clothes, gets her kill kit ready, and she sneaks out the back to a rental car that she and Simon left there earlier. So she drives to where Carl, One of her patient's abusive husbands plays poker and waits for him. There's a paragraph of backstory about how Carl becomes sexually aggressive with his wife when he comes home drunk from his poker games. When Hope sees Carl leaving the game, she pops the hood of her rental car, waves him down as he's driving up the street, and asks for his help with her car. He tries to refuse her, telling her he needs to get home, but she plays to his ego and he gets out of the car to help her. When he's leaning under the hood of the car to inspect it, she collapses the hood on top of him. She jumps on top of the hood. She lifts his shirt tail, injects him with a sedative. She moves his car, hoists him into the passenger side, and drives to a lake where she meets up with Simon. They roll the car into a lake. Once it's fully submerged, Simon asks Hope if she remembered to strap Carl in the seatbelt, which would keep him tethered inside the car. And she says, oh, shit.
Dun, dun, dun. Right. Thank you, Jennifer. Okay, we're going to hand it across now to Cece.
Thank you. That was a really good summary, by the way. We usually have to summarize the pages ourselves when we don't have the authors on the show. And you did a great job. So congratulations on that. Okay, so as I was reading this, I think my big picture note to you is you are explaining too much, in my opinion and for my taste, and I'm going to try to make my case to you. We begin with her telling us that she needs an alibi, and then she explains the plan, right? And then she tells us how Simon only helps her so far, and then we see her totally in control. The one line of emotion we get reads, I wasn't just ready, I was excited. And then we see her doing all the things you described, right? Like making sure she gets noticed, flagging his car down. Why she's killing him, we also know, because to your point, we got that paragraph of backstory. As I was reading this, I was writing down notes in the margins, and my notes read things like, hey, she's really in control. No disruption, no tension. Is this intentional? Is this how you want this to read? Not enough emotionality. Like, her layers of emotion should be messy. I love that she's excited, but she's not just excited. I can promise you that. No human being who's about to kill someone is feeling only one thing. I know that because no human being who's about to confront someone for yelling feels only one thing. So let alone killing, I can only imagine that that is a lot messier. When she's confronting him, obviously in character, right, about the car, there's no emotionality in terms of how she feels about him. And I really, really wanted layers and layers of active emotion. I'll give you an example of something that I think would be really, really interesting. And not so you can use this example, because likely it won't fit, but so you can kind of like understand what I'm looking for. She's a person in control who's like a badass and is about to kill someone and is convinced this person deserves to die. And he's like a terrible man. Like, this human does deserve to die in the story. I very much agree. And yet, wouldn't it be interesting if underneath her excitement and her fury and her conviction, something about him, maybe, for example, when he puffs his chest, because there's a mention to he puffs his chest noticeably. Maybe she thinks of how all pathetic men love to puff their chest when they're trying to save a damsel in distress. I don't know. Maybe she would think something like that. And then maybe he trips or something. And for a moment, she feels sorry for him, like a flashing moment. And then she surprises herself. She surprises herself because she had imagined feeling all these emotions, including perhaps second thoughts, but not pity. And she does. When a character surprises themselves with an emotion, that is really interesting. Because you're telling me what they expected to feel, and you're telling me how they actually felt, and these things don't match. And that level of surprise can really, really elevate pages. And yeah, I wanted to know. I also wanted psychological depth. So again, to the whole, like, when she was complimenting him, we got a line that read, I stood next to him, infusing more gratitude and compliments while he inspected the oil dipstick. And I was like, does she find this pathetic? In her experience, are men like this more likely to whatever her therapist brain would come up with? Like, there was just very little deep interiority. And she's a therapist who's about to kill someone. I really wanted to be inside her head. I did highlight the sentence in which she kills him, or like she uses the murder weapon. And I'll read it here for you. When he stuck his head back under the hood a final time, comma, I slammed it on him with as much force as I could, open parentheses. I'd been lifting weights for months in preparation, close parentheses, comma, jumped on top of the hood to weigh it down, comma, quickly lifted the tail of his shirt, comma, and inserted the syringe into his back, period. If you go to your favorite books and you see the scenes where people are stabbing a needle, stabbing a knife, I promise you that's not how it's going to read. The writer would lengthen the sentence. They would isolate the moment. They would put visceral emotion first, something, right? Like you're writing it on a, as a list with commas, like they did this and this and this. And its reading is very clinical and very detached. And I don't think you're doing your story justice. I actually gave you a little homework, which was, please reread the paragraph where she kills him. Notice how detached she sounds. And I'm wondering why you're holding back. Is it because you're afraid you're going to like describing the scene too much if you don't? Now, see, that's my own psychological contribution to this and my own theory. And that's what I want your character to do. I want her to be theorizing, projecting, assuming, questioning, filling in gaps. I want her brain to be working in a way that propels the story forward and develops her character at the same time. If you go to your first comp, first book comp, My Lovely Wife, that starts with him at a bar talking to a woman. We have no idea that he's about to do something terrible with that woman. The author lengthens the moment. She keeps us in suspense, thinking that this is just a guy who's about to hit on someone, thinking that he's actually deaf. He's not. He's pretending to be deaf. And that's mystery. That's withholding to then reveal, as opposed to explaining it up front. So I would take a page from Samantha Downing, and to everyone who has not read My Lovely Wife, go read it. It's a very excellent book.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Jennifer, before we come back to you, we're going to get Carly's take, and then you get to ask all the questions. Carly?
All right, so back to what Cece was saying about the questioning, because I think the big part for me was, how did we get to murder? You know, like, I think that's my big question. Like, if you knew he drives drunk once a week, I forget how frequent the poker game is, or once a month, why wouldn't you, your first thing be like, I'm going to call the cops and try to get him, you know, arrested driving home. Like, I'm just so curious about why, like, we're just going straight to the death part. I don't know. Like, and that's what my note in the middle was, like, could she second guess herself here at the point where she knows he's going to drive home drunk? At that moment, she's like, I have the decision to make whether I'm going to follow through with the plan or whether I just, you know, call 911 about seeing somebody stumble into their car with blood all over them and reeking of alcohol. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like, that was like a, you know, choose your path moment, that there's an opportunity for that. And I think it would have given us a glimpse into her mindset about why she was so set on the outcome, which she ended up deciding, which was murder. That was a huge, huge question mark for me. All in all, like, I really did like the specifics because they were written so well. And I know what Cece means, like, it's a bit of a play-by-play of what happens. It is really well written, and it is subversive because it's like people don't sit down to dinner with their husband and go on a date night, and it's like, actually, this is our alibi for murder. So I did actually find everything incredibly well written. But a lot of it felt, this is where I think I'm getting tripped up. A lot of it felt like it was for the reader and not for the story, especially when you get into the bit about the husband and the play-by-play of what would usually happen on a night when he came home from poker and, you know, how Lucy would feel in that moment. I think there was a huge opportunity there to also see things through Lucy's point of view, and then we didn't. I don't know if it would even just be like a quote of like, oh, Lucy said this in therapy one time and I remember her saying this, like a direct quote, just to like bring it back to her as a person, as opposed to like therapy notes almost, is kind of how it came off to me. So yeah, I don't know. I did feel like a lot of this was for the reader, which I know this sounds silly because like every book is for a reader, Carly, like what are you talking about? But sometimes when I feel the purpose and like the strong arming towards the reader, having with the author trying to produce what they think the reader needs in this moment, I can feel a bit like I'm seeing the puppet strings. And so I think ultimately I have the same reaction as Cece. I just have it a bit of a different way.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Jennifer, we're passing it across to you now. This is where you get to fill in the blanks, ask us questions, or get us to brainstorm on how you might do things differently.
This has just been outstanding help. I took a lot of notes. I have gotten beta reader feedback as well that mirrors precisely what you all are saying in terms of, you got to be kidding me. This is her first murder, and you know she's Mrs. Robot already, where she can just sort of go into it like cold-blooded, you know, killer person. And we do get into a ton more interiority with her later. Once she's in prison, she feeds off the energy of the women that surround her because they sort of worship her. And she's just constantly thinking about how she is this savior. She's this helper. She's this sort of champion for the women. But ahead of that, you know, I'm sort of painting this picture of, you know, and I think I got Dexter in my head and point taken on the query letter for sure in terms of removing those comps. But I think in terms of modeling sort of that cold-bloodedness, I didn't do her character justice in these opening pages because she is a human being. She does have feelings and anxieties, and those really flesh out later. But to give a lot more leading in and some hints and some anxiety and some tension in that first chapter is going to be really important because I think it's going to have some foreshadowing effect for what happens when she is in prison and she's faced with her own, you know, sort of other side of the coin, if you will, in terms of her being on the victim side of things. Also, you know, when Carly mentioned, you know, sort of how did we get to this murder? And that also really strikes a chord with me in terms of, you know, no one knows yet that these women have called the cops on their husbands, have suffered, even though Hope goes with these women to the cops to try and get these restraining orders and get these husbands out of these women's lives. And those were all the steps they had taken up to this point. And so, you know, that isn't clear here. And so we're jumping into this murder. And Carly, your point is just really well taken that it seems, you know, it could be that it's abrupt, or it could be that there just needs to be something in there that really helps the reader understand that this is a choice that she has made for these certain reasons.
There was something Cece just wanted to hop in with. Cece?
I was very quickly going to say that, you know, this is a situation where you're going to have to choose, but I disagree that we have to understand why she's killing someone. Why someone is killing someone is a huge motivation that I want to understand, but not in the first five pages, certainly not in the first chapter. I want it to be more suspenseful and seductive. Again, my lovely wife, that first chapter, there was no explanation on why he was doing what he was doing. I want to wonder. I want to see inside her head. I want her to be psychoanalyzing and projecting and inferring and sharing in a way that leads to suspense. I don't want to understand. But again, that's just me.
Yeah, and I don't think you have to spell it out, but even just a line about like, maybe I could try one last time to call the cops, even though it didn't work the seven other times we called them. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like, it could be like that much of wording. It doesn't have to be a whole deep dive into the backstory.
Yeah, just on that, you know, plant curiosity seeds in terms of the reader becoming actively involved with trying to figure out why these particular men, why she's chosen these people as victims, etc. So, you know, instead of spilling or giving us all the goods up front, you really can write it in a way that makes the reader actively like curious about why this specific man at this specific time. And then they've got to wait for that payoff to find out why as they put the puzzle pieces together. That's also something to consider. I know you had other questions for us, Jennifer, so go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to circle back with both of you on sort of this. Oh, maybe it's a question of clarification. When I hear you say, you know, maybe there's some explaining going on and maybe not as much in terms of bringing the reader into the story, but just explaining to the reader, does that feel like it's telling instead of showing, or am I not, maybe I just need some clarification. So when I do go back and make these revisions, I can be very intentional.
I think my answer to that would be, we have this opportunity to be in first person because that's how you've created this world. And I mean, there is a bit of scene work, but there's not a lot of scene work. I think that's kind of where the distance is happening and the summary is happening. Because if we were, I think when we are in scene, I think is the parts that I love the best. You know, when I was talking about the first page, you know, everything talking about how she's kind of interacting at the restaurant and how, and that kind of play by play. So I think again, this is all very subjective. I think I would like for us to just stay in scene a little bit more. And I think that's why the summary about, you know, Lucy Kim's husband was at his poker game. He did this, like, you know, that little backstory about the husband that wasn't in scene. Cause if we had have had like Lucy explaining the situation in scene in the office or something like that, then we would, I don't know, just have a bit more of a character understanding of the moment as opposed to it being factual. I don't know if that makes sense at all.
Cece?
So for me, it's two parts. One, there are a lot of sentences that are pure explanation. It's not interiority. It's not framed through her point of view. She's not assigning value, meaning she's not framing it through her lenses. And I highlighted those for you. I think you'll be very clear on what I mean. A good example is the backstory on the husband. It's clinical. Like, you're writing it in a clinical way. Again, I do wonder, and this is not the point of the show, but I do wonder why you're holding back. Like, I'm very curious, and I have like five different theories in my head, but you are holding back. Like, you are purposely writing it in a way that is detached and clinical, and like, this is why. And it's too early. And even if it's not too early in your opinion, the sentences should be framed through her view. And that view should be filled with visceral emotions. The best way to make a sentence that is pure explanation into wonderful interiority is to add emotion. You know, it's the difference between Carl is my brother and my brother Carl frustrated me so much. You know, neither of these are particularly good sentences, but the second sentence is not pure explanation. The second sentence has emotion, has her opinion of him. Has, you know, maybe you could even be like, ever since we were kids, Carl has done this to me. Now I also have family history, things like that. And it's hard to do when you're describing someone else, but even though it's not her abusive husband, everything has to be framed through her eyes. And the second thing is, we have a lot of lines where you're just giving away all the goods. That's what I mean by explanation too. Things like, Simon was critical to the mission, comma, providing me with the deadly cocktail for my mark. I wanted to figure that out, you know, like I didn't want you to tell me so explicitly, because notice how there's no emotion in that sentence. It's pure clinical explanation. Even the fact that this was her first time killing someone, that was also quite clinical. I did highlight these for you. So again, you will have like notes that will hopefully help, and all our subscribers will see those notes too. But it was just framed in a way that was very, very, very explicitly explaining as opposed to seducing.
I think all in all, I think what I'm trying to get at is also that it lacks that kind of like interpersonal connection, because this is also a moment that is going to change her and her husband's relationship forever, because she's already like brought him in to help with the killing, and he knows that he's setting her up for that. And is he on board with it? Does she think like, our relationship's going to change forever? He's going to see me in a different way. Did he want to do the killing? And then she was like, I want to do the kill. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, that was a whole thing. Now, again, not that you have to explain all of this, but we never see that interpersonally. And then we never see her and her client interpersonally. This is, again, that is all factual, like it's notes. So I think that's what I'm missing, is just any sort of on the page interpersonal connection that is not related to the play-by-play of the situation.
Does that make sense, Jennifer?
It sure does. And what you all are tapping into is the symptoms of the disease of having been an academic writer for almost 20 years. And so people like me who are making this transition from academic writing or journalistic time, sometimes we're writing white papers and things like that, you know, we're into this detail oriented and very explicit, as opposed to, you know, the seductive or for the story. And so I am a work in progress. This is a work in progress. And this has just been incredibly helpful. And I am just so grateful.
Can it also be because you want to kind of kill a little bit? I think that's also a fun reason. Like, deep, deep down, do you want to know what it's like to kill this guy who was horrible? I think it's my thing, right? Like, clearly I'm projecting here. Like, part of me is like, man, I wish I could do that.
There's a backstory to why I wrote this story. So yes, there's personal experience always, right? It's not writing what you know. It's writing what you might know if you actually did the thing you're not supposed to do.
Excellent point. Yes.
Carly, you were saying you're recovering journalists and academics.
Oh, yes. About how I've worked with a lot of academics and journalists, and transitioning to what I call a quote unquote accessible writing is so hard. And what happens is journalists are not used to putting themselves into the situation. And so you are, I know you're an academic, but you are trying to then create a first person, an I, and you have never written an I before. And so that is very challenging. So I'm actually really curious about why you decided to go with first person instead of third, because third might have actually come a little bit more naturally to you in terms of transitioning into accessibility. But it could be obviously for the sake of the story, this makes sense. But that is why I think this is so hard, is because this is first person, potentially.
Maybe I like
pain. Love it. I think all writers have to be masochists or sadists, right, to a certain degree, right? So that's how we know we're writers. Well, Jennifer, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you so, so much for joining us. We wish you much luck with this project as you, you know, go through this whole period of becoming a sort of reformed journalist and become a fiction writer.
Thank you all so very, very much. I appreciate this time together.
Wonderful. Okay, thank you, Carly and Cece. Appreciate it as always. Let's go to today's guest.
Hello, listeners. This is Cece. Question for you. What do all the very best stories have in common? The ability to make us feel. Which is why learning how to weave emotions into your writing is so important. And I am so excited to announce that I am teaching my super popular writing emotion class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, August 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time via Zoom to learn all about the craft of writing emotions, common mistakes, tips and tricks, and lots of practical examples from novels and memoirs you love. Then we'll meet again on Monday, August 12th. For a live cozy Q&A session in which you will have the option to turn on your camera and ask questions in real time. If you can't attend one or both sessions live, make sure to sign up, because everyone who is registered before August 8th will get recordings 24 hours later. For more information, head to my Instagram profile and click on the link in my bio. I hope to see you there.
Today's guest is the Globe and Mail bestselling author of 14 novels, including the Globe and Mail bestselling Recipe for a Good Life, Nosy Parker, which was named one of Indigo's top 100 books of 2022, The Spoon Stealer, longlisted for Canada Reads 2022, Beholden, Mary Mary, Amazing Grace, Kin, and Relative Happiness, which was adapted into an award-winning feature film. She has also published two collections of essays, the Leacock longlisted Are You Kidding Me? And I Kid You Not. Leslie lives in Homeville, Nova Scotia. Visit her at lesliecrew.com. It's my pleasure to welcome Leslie Crew. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's been a long time.
I know. We tried to set this up a year ago and it didn't happen. So it's incredible to finally have you on. For our listeners, I'm going to read you the flap copy of the book we're discussing today, which is called Death and Other Inconveniences. Well, Dick's dead. Now what? Margot, his widow, is trying to dodge the tsunami of paperwork and other tasks coming her way. She doesn't deal with details. Why do you think she was married in the first place? Dick always handled the drudgery. Not terribly well, it turns out. Margot's ex-husband, the first one, not the dead one, and their two adult children are trying to support Margot, who seems to be finally entering adulthood at the tender age of 62. Dead Dick's ex-wife and their daughter consider Margot a man-eater, so the funeral is a nightmare. Life in New Brunswick lately is a tornado of siblings, children, pets, marriages, health issues, and endless bureaucracy. And at the center of it all is Margot, living alone for the very first time, going back to work as a drugstore cashier to make ends meet, and trying to endure everyone else's judgments about the woman she is when she barely knows herself. How old do you have to be to come of age? And has anyone seen Dick's will? With humor and heart, national bestseller Leslie Crew walks readers through the incredibly disruptive domino effects of the death of one unremarkable man and the evolution of the flibbertigibbet wife he's left behind. Right, so this is one of the most hilarious books I have read in a long time. And I've read a lot of humor books over the last few years. This one had me giggling out loud constantly, that my husband was waking up to glare at me and give me dirty looks over this. So Leslie, kudos to you on this incredibly, incredibly funny book. Before we dive into the specifics of it, can you speak a bit about writing humor and writing humor well?
Well, it's just something I seem to do. It seems like one book is usually maybe a little darker, and then the next one will be a little lighter. I don't like to grovel in sad things for too long, especially now when the world is bananas. You need to laugh. You need to get out of this darkness that we're all in. And I just find silly, ordinary things incredibly compelling. It's just easy for me to see the funny side of things, even though I've had so much loss and everything else. But I like doing both. I like making people cry and making people laugh.
Yeah, and the two balance out wonderfully. But there are some one-liners here that just kind of land with these zingers that make a person giggle. Is it a case of that's how it just comes out for you? You're someone who's predisposed to writing humor and you write it well? Or sometimes does it take, you know, quite a few edits to really get something like that to land?
No, it tends to just come. I usually write the way I speak, so it seems to hold me in good stead.
Yeah, I think writing humor isn't something that can be taught. I think you're either kind of good at it and you can elevate it, of course. You can edit it and get feedback from people to see if jokes are landing or not. But I don't think that that is something that you can teach to someone who isn't naturally funny. And for our listeners, I can attest to just emailing back and forth with Leslie has been hilarious. So you can see her incredible sense of humor coming through there. Right, I'm going to read you the first page just so you can get a sense of this humor. And then we're going to dive into some questions. So here we go. Chapter 1, Obituary. Richard Dickie Bird Ambrose Sterling Fredericton, New Brunswick, 1960 to 2023. The family is horrified to announce Dick's sudden and totally expected passing thanks to a chunk of ham sandwich while he sat in his living room recliner watching the Stanley Cup playoff finals between the Vegas Golden Knights and the Florida Panthers. He would want me to mention that his favorite team won. Go Vegas. He was born in Bathurst, New Brunswick, to parents Jerry and Doris, I think. They're dead. Survived by stunned and furious wife Margot Donovan, a vegetarian hockey hater, his daughter Velma and her latest partner Joanne something, and his long-suffering, in her own mind, first wife Carol. He never saw his siblings, so no need to mention them, other than he called them Larry, Curly, and Moe, along with their spouses, April, May, and June. Can you believe that? Dick was a butcher. He loved barbecuing, watching hockey, gambling, and drinking beer. Look where that got him. Arrangements will be announced. In terms of attention-grabbing openings, Leslie, this one was hilarious. I was like, first, oh my God, did they publish this obituary? And then you read to see the woman wrote this in shock. She's not very good at doing it. And her daughter completely rewrites it for her. Was that always going to be the opening?
Well, this book was a little different for me. Usually I just do everything in one draft most of the time. This one took me three. I was 3,000 words in when I realized I had killed off the only character I liked. So I had to start over again. And then I thought, okay, now I need some more family. This is about the death of a man. It's not funny, but it's about the life that happens afterwards. I originally had it like as an older couple and whatever, they've been forever together. And I thought, no, that's not going to work because I don't want this guy to die. I want somebody to die who they're having problems, or they don't even know they're having problems, but they're having problems. It's a second husband. She's been with him for 10 years. It needs to be not quite so traumatic. So then I did the second draft and I added all these characters, but I got into too many characters' heads. Then I had to pare down once again. It really was a completely frustrating book to write, but I got there in the end because now I love Margot. I don't care that Dick died. That's why I wanted to start with the obituary. I didn't want to bring him in as a character, just everybody's reaction to his death. So he doesn't really matter. So I did that on purpose.
Yeah, and I love that. And it's something I want to chat about. So in terms of inciting incidences, you know, for our listeners, the inciting incident is what kicks off everything. It starts the dominoes tipping. It answers the why now, why today question in terms of why is the story starting now as opposed to 2 months ago or a year from now. And most of the times we see the inciting incident on the page. Now, this is the kind of novel, it's broken a few rules and we're going to discuss them, but it's broken them incredibly well. So remember, if you're going to break these rules, you need to do it well. So the inciting incident is his death. It is never on the page. We begin afterwards with the obituary and everybody responding to it. So that's pretty difficult to pull off, Leslie, in terms of, you know, having that inciting incident off the page. But I love that you've just explained to us why you did that, because you didn't want him to be a character who we became attached to. You wanted to show the fallout after his death.
Yes, he's not the important one in this story. Poor guy.
Well, it's his death that kicks everything off, but that was very intentional on Leslie's part. So it's deciding to keep the inciting incident off the page for a very intentional reason. Now, something else that we generally say to emerging writers, because I get to review a lot of manuscripts and we get to look at a lot of manuscripts for our Books with Hook segment. And what we often see emerging authors make a mistake with is they begin with there I was minding my own business when X happened. And then they show the characters reacting and responding to X. And we generally say, stay away from that because it doesn't give a character agency. We don't clearly see what the character wants. So in general, we say begin with something that a character desperately wants. Show us why it's important to them that they want what they want so that we can understand the stakes, and then show them the whole book going after this thing that they want and showing various obstacles being thrown in their path. And we generally say, stay away from I was minding my own business when, because with those kinds of beginnings, we generally don't see what a character wants, what the stakes are, etc. But you started with there I was minding my own business when Dick died, and now I've got to deal with the fallout of this. But you still managed to work the various characters' wants and needs and the stakes into that kind of opening. So can you discuss that a bit, how you can start with that kind of opening, but still make it compelling so that there's causality in terms of X happens, which leads to Y happening, and so that the reader understands what the stakes are as the characters try and get what they want to get?
For me, it was just a matter of this happened to her. She didn't want it to happen to her, obviously, but it did. Now you see her struggle, not just through what's happening to her, because she's in a really bad way anyway, but then you see her fight through it, through the reactions of her family. Because sometimes you don't know what you're doing in a time of distress. You're often not clear-headed enough to know what's happening. And obviously with a death too, you rely on your family. And when you're a woman of a certain age, those are your children. Your children are going to help you. But you have relationships with those children. And it makes it difficult. I know I'm not answering your question. I'm trying to figure out what it is.
So what I was going at is that even though she's minding her own business when he dies, she quickly has wants and needs and stakes. So for example, straight after he dies, Margot is trying to deal with the fallout of the funeral. She doesn't want to deal with his ex-wife. She doesn't want to deal with his daughter. But these are things she's having to traverse. And there are stakes tied to that. And her daughter doesn't want to have to deal with all of this, but her daughter is trying to get her mother through all of these things. So each of them quickly have wants and needs that become new wants and needs, because Margot needs a new job. She needs to financially look after herself. So even though you started in this way, you show us very quickly what all the characters want and need and why it's important.
Yeah, because I mean, let's face it, when somebody dies, that's what you have to do. Your life stops as it was, and then suddenly you're faced with something else completely different. It's happening to a lot of women my age. You know, some of us have lost our husbands, and your life ends, and then you have to go on. It's very easy for me to do that for that character, because she's gone from one place to another place in the matter of a few moments. You know, and that's the shock of sudden death. And I know that very well. So it felt true to me to be able to have her have all kinds of things happen and then struggle with it all. And that's what the whole book was about. And actually, it's all started, my husband had heart surgery just before Christmas. And at one point, one day, I was fiddling with the remote, not very well. And he said, you know, Les, if something happens to me, you're never going to watch TV again, because I didn't know how to work the remote. And I thought, yeah, he's right. I said, and I won't be able to do the snow plow. I won't be able to use the generator. I won't be able to know how to the water pump. I mean, there's a million things here. I live in the middle of nowhere. I will be stuck. So that was the whole premise of, oh my God, you know, I'd be good money-wise because I can handle the finances, but that's where the idea of this book came from. Just that casual remark that you're never going to watch TV again. And he makes you realize, okay, he's right. So it's a good thing he came through just fine.
Yeah. And you know what I love about that is, again, it shows that characters' wants and needs can be small things. I'm the same. I cannot switch our TV on. I would also never be able to watch television. I'm useless with that. But it becomes whether the character just wants to figure out how to use a remote control, whether they want to be able to leave the funeral with their husband's ashes, whether they want to be able to go to the bathroom without being harassed by, you know, a very dramatic ex-wife. These are all wants and needs. And these are the things that make up good fiction, when characters want and need things. And they can be small things. They don't need to be wanting world peace or wanting some huge thing. And their wants and needs can change. So can you take us a bit through Margot in terms of her character arc and her evolution, how she started off wanting smaller things and how they became bigger things in terms of how she changed over the course of the story?
Well, Margot always thought of herself as that she couldn't really do a lot. The only thing she was known for was her looks. And she had an older brother and sister and older parents who indulged her. And then she ended up marrying a man who was very nice. He's still her friend. But she's always depended on the kindness of strangers. She's always depended on her husband or her children or her brother and sister. Always somebody else. It's like she didn't want to think. She doesn't like to think about things. You know, she just wants to go on with her life and not worry. Well, that comes at a cost, because she knows she's not capable, but she covers that all up. The one thing she's very good at is makeup, and she does that very well. So that's the one thing that she hangs on to, and she uses it as a crutch, really. And then she finds herself in this, I don't give away the whole story, but her first husband runs off with another man, and it kind of explains their relationship. She's relieved, because she could never figure out. She loved Monty and he was sweet with her, but they really didn't connect. And that's because, of course, that he was a gay man trying to live this life. And he does. He loves her. But they obviously, you know, weren't really connected. So then she finds herself alone, and she's not used to being alone. And then she meets a man who is like pure sex. Like, that's the only thing he's got going for him. And that fills a need that she didn't even know she needed. And so that was his only charm. And of course, after 10 years, she's starting to realize that's his only charm. But before things get really bad for them, he up and dies. And then, of course, after he's left her in a bad way, you know, and she loses everything. So it's bad enough to lose your husband, but to lose your home, to lose everything. Like, she's starting back from day one, and she feels like she's a failure. She's a failure in the eyes of her children. She's a failure in the eyes of her brother and sister. Not her sister, but her brother is kind of cranky about it. Never thought she should have married this yahoo in the first place. And her husband, too, is, you know, they're all worried about her. They're all, you know, worried about her. Now they really have to worry about her. Because at least when she was with Dick, well, nobody really had to deal with mom so much anymore. It's like she was happy because she was a grandmother and, you know, they didn't have to go running off. But now she's alone and everybody has to come to her rescue. And she starts to realize over the course of the book, at first she wants everybody to come to her rescue. You want people to do that for you. And then she realizes it's not making her feel good. It's not making her feel better. It's making her feel worse. But she doesn't realize that the little things suddenly become bigger things. She has to live with her children, and she realizes she doesn't want to live with her children. Loves them dearly, but oh my God, there's nothing worse. And so that leads to, you know, needing to get another apartment, and she has no money. So now she has to get a job. Like all the things that she really resents having to do at the age of 62. She figures she's got to the age where she's done her bit. She's raised her family. You know, she's retired. All of these good things have happened to her. And then suddenly she's back to square one, not realizing, of course, that in the process of all this, she did need to grow up. She was basically a very childish adult. And now she's someone that even she is a little proud of.
Yeah, her character arc was incredible. She made me think of a modern day Scarlett O'Hara, you know, just wanting to bury her head in the sand and not think about unpleasant things. But it was awesome. Something that I'm going to focus on now for our last time together, because it's something that Leslie has done so well. And we also see emerging writers making this mistake, is when it comes to an omniscient kind of narrator. Most times when people try and write this, they head hop from paragraph to paragraph, from sentence to sentence, so that the reader comes away feeling a bit punch drunk, because it's like a tennis match. You hopping between heads and you feel dizzy. I'm going to read you two instances where Leslie transitioned from one character's POV to another that you wouldn't even notice it unless you were paying close attention. So here we go. So, and now here it was, late at night, and her daughter was in her kitchen looking like she just got out of bed, which she had. Harmon had called her, and she stayed with Margot until Julia showed up. Margot was still shaking with the shock, despite the hot tea spiked with sherry and warm blanket wrapped around her. So over here, we're in Margot's POV. Julia held the obituary hastily scribbled on the back of an envelope. Mother, seriously. Margot grabbed several tissues out of a box on the kitchen counter and blew her nose as Julia dropped into the nearest chair. Mom, you can't use this obituary. I can't. Why not? It's the truth. Isn't that what you're supposed to write? The truth? There are levels of truth. First of all, don't put Dickie Bird. It's gross. And speaking of that, don't say he choked on a late night snack. Let them assume it was something dignified, like a heart attack or a stroke. Margot kept dabbing her eyes. Also, the language you use is important. You don't say his parents are dead. They are dead. You say he was predeceased by his parents, blah, blah. You can't say expected death. It's supposed to be unexpected. And furious wife makes you sound like a harpy. But I am furious. All this was totally preventable. Julia sighed. Take out vegetarian, because you're not. Hockey hater, no one cares. And for God's sake, find out your aunt's last name. Also put in his brother's real names. Don't mention Carol at all if you can't say anything other than long suffering. You don't want to be sued for defamation. Margot was exhausted. You sound like a teacher going over my homework. I'm reeling, Julia. I'm distressed. I just found my cold, dead husband in a chair. So stop giving me grief. Julia put her hand on her mother's shoulder. You're right. I'm sorry. This is awful. But please don't feel you have to do this right now. Or would you like me to do it? You do it. I can't believe I'm a widow. I look terrible in black. You'll be fine, Mom. Think Jackie Kennedy. That's true. Her mother wandered out of the kitchen with the blanket trailing behind her. Julia sent her husband, Andre, a text because he'd asked her to. Kill me now. He replied, do not take over. Then she texted her brother, Mike. He was a night owl. Dick died. Three little dots appeared moving on the screen. What? The Dickster? What happened? He choked on a ham sandwich. Totally not surprised, but shit, poor dude. Should I call Mom? No. Tomorrow. She's lying down. Julia knew she had to call her aunt and uncle, even though it was really late, because if she didn't, Aunt Uni would give her an earful about how they were always the last to know everything. So have a look there how Leslie transitioned from Margot's POV very, very seamlessly into Julia's POV, so that you didn't even notice the change, and you certainly didn't feel confused by it or like you were head hopping. There's one more part I'm going to read as well, and then I want to discuss this with Leslie to see her advice for doing this. Now, this is Mike's POV. So this is Margot's son. We start with Mike. At a lull in the mourners coming through the door, Mike saw his mother looking pale, lean on his sister, and Julia took her by the arm and left the room. He looked to Alenka. Don't worry, she said. She'd probably need some air or the washroom. As they disappeared, Carol, the grim weeper, took her cane and struggled off her perch to follow his mom, but she seemed to be in slow motion. Velma practically marched on the spot behind her. Uncle Hazen slapped his knee. Gunfight at the OK Corral. This wasn't funny. Mike sidled off with a link on his tail. Everyone else pretended nothing was happening. He heard shouts from inside the washroom, went to shove the door open. Alenka pushed him aside. Mike, don't. You'll make it worse. Let me handle this. Leave his girlfriend to handle what was essentially call of duty? This should be good. Alenka opened the door and found them facing off by the sink. Females fighting over a male. Behavior as old as time. Carol was wielding her cane like a weapon. You man-eating bitch. Velma whirled towards Margot. You made that ham sandwich, didn't you? You killed him. And so it goes in the bathroom scene. And then we get to the point where it ends, where Alenka gets us all under control. And enough, Alenka shouted. They all looked at her, surprised to see her in the washroom. This is ridiculous. You're behaving no better than a couple of honey badgers who face their enemy, produce a rattle roar, stand with their hair on end, emit stink bombs, and then charge. Basically what you're doing now in this public washroom during a civilized wake for the man you supposedly loved. Now get out of there and conduct yourselves appropriately. This is a solemn occasion. Stop the spectacle. Both Julia and Margot looked grateful for the intervention and left quickly. Velma and Carol were confused. Who are you? Animal control. They gave her dirty looks, but they left. Alenka took a quick minute to pee while she had the chance and joined Mike, who stood there looking perplexed. What just happened? It all comes down to biology, Michael. I told them they were acting like honey badgers in the wild and they couldn't calm down fast enough. Michael blinked and stared at his best friend with her cat's eye glasses and very short bangs, who even with her dress on had a pocket protector and a few pens. I love you. Well, get over it. So there we went from Mike to Alenka and back to Mike again. So Leslie, advice to people who are wanting to write omniscient points of view. How do you stop the reader from being super confused? Whose head's they in? How do you stop the headhunting and do it in a really seamless way?
Well, you have to be aware at all times that somebody is reading this and you're very aware of the story by this point, but other people aren't. So you have to make it as clear as possible who's speaking, who is answering. You don't want to bring too many people in at once, but it needs to be perfectly clear that somebody is talking and it's their voice. And then you can move out of that voice quite easily if you leave the room, you know, answer somebody. There's all kinds of different tricks for keeping it going. You have to keep the scene rolling and pretend it's just like if you were talking to somebody yourself. I never have a problem with dialogue because, like I say, I write the way I speak. So I always hear it in my head. Try and do that because if you're thinking about it in your head or saying it out loud, you can hear very quickly if something doesn't feel right, if something is confusing. I'll always read it back to myself. And if I'm confused, well, then I know I have to figure, you know, something else out. But I think it's easy. You know, you put people on the phone and then they hang up and then you talk to somebody else and then they have a like you try not to have everybody have a reaction all at once. But it, you know what? It comes with practice. It's practice. It's a hard thing to do. And you'll learn yourself, you know, what is easier and what's not easy. I don't think about writing as being full of rules. I never intended to be published. I wasn't interested in being published. My books are just long-winded diaries. I only write for myself. And I've just had a little bit of practice now. I do tend to think about readers now after 16 books. I'm aware that people are reading it, but I try to go back to the very first book, which is I was just writing for myself. And I could hear these conversations in my head. And I've just continued to do that. I've never taken a writing course. I've never taken anything. I've done everything the wrong way. So, you know, I might as well just continue.
Doing it the wrong way and doing it really well is incredible because a lot of people will sit down and intentionally try and do it the right way and they'll get it wrong. So the fact that you don't even think about it and you get it right. But for our listeners, something I noticed here, if you do want some practical advice on how to do this, is it's almost what Leslie's doing is almost like a relay race when you have to pass the baton or the baton to the next person to run. It's like while that person is holding the baton and they're running, she is with them completely. And then as soon as they pass it on to the next person by leaving the room or coming back into the room or ending a telephone conversation, as soon as that baton has passed to the next person, then the spotlight is completely on them, as opposed to having two people just passing it backwards and forwards the whole time. So think about it in terms of a relay. While that person has it for however long they're running for, the spotlight's on them, then they get to hand it on to the next person, and the spotlight's on them until they hand it on to someone else. And that's how you kind of stop the head hopping. Because Leslie did it so well that I read past it and suddenly I was like, hold on a minute, this is sneaky. I'm in another character's point of view and I didn't even realize it, because there wasn't a scene break or a chapter break or any of the things we expect when this happens. So yeah, Leslie, you may not have thought about craft a lot, but you have nailed it.
Thank you. Thank you. That means a lot.
Any advice you have for emerging authors before we finish chatting today?
In my experience, you just need to write for yourself. I've always found throughout my life, if I put things down on paper, I could see them clearly. And then when I read whatever I've written, I think, oh, well, that's what I think. You know, I have to take it out of myself. And then I'm able to look at something objectively. So if you have something in your heart, something that is calling to you, you need to get it down. If you're a writer, that's the way you do it. If you're a singer, that's, you know, that's a different way. But to write something, it needs to resonate with you. You need a reason why you're writing it. And I had a reason why I wrote my first book very clearly. And it's just gone from there. So I keep doing the same thing over and over again. I'll just keep writing stories that mean something to me. And the thing is, I write about ordinary things and all my readers recognize I'm not writing any great literature. I'm just writing stories and people recognize themselves in the stories. And that's why they get so attached to these stories. Because, I mean, we all had someone die on us. We've all been to a funeral. We've all know what it's like not to have a lot of money, or, you know, it's just silly little things. And trying to write an obituary, which is actually, that's kind of what I started doing. I was helping a friend write her mother's obituary, and the names in the family kept coming up. She was from New Brunswick. And that's why I dedicate the book to her, because it was tough for her to write this obituary. And I get asked that all the time. I write a lot of obituaries for friends and things, but just because I know how to put a couple of, you know, words together. But it needs to speak to you before it can speak to anybody else. So, and be like the dear little boy. I was in a school one day, the writers in school program, and you go in, and of course the kids are all just happy their teacher isn't there. But there's always one or two in every class, and you know that they're interested. And this little boy came up to me. His name was Duncan. He was in grade 4. And he said, this is your lucky day. I'm a writer too. So I thought that was precious, because he hadn't written anything, but he knew he was a writer. And I think, be like Duncan. You know, don't go on thinking that you have to have your book done. You need to have it done by the time you're 30. I wrote my first book at 50. I didn't care. Well, like I said, I wasn't planning on being published. So, I mean, it didn't matter. But don't put so much pressure on yourself. You know, be kind to yourself. You're not going to get it right the very first time. And it's just the experience of writing something that may make you feel better, not the publishing of it.
Absolutely perfect place to end today. Thank you so much for that wonderful advice, Leslie. We're going to link to Death and Other Inconveniences on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you buy it there, you support an independent bookstore, you support the podcast, and you support Leslie. Leslie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Bianca. It was really a pleasure. It was lovely to meet you.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and CC Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and CC on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000 word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be.